Radio.
Making Sense of Marriage, a talk and Q&A session with Patrick Langrell at the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015, held at the Adelaide Convention Centre.
Firstly, I'm going to try and make you all smarter than 99% of the world when it comes to thinking through this issue. And I'm going to do that in 5 minutes. Bam. Second thing, I'm going to point out a few obstacles and difficulties that people have who argue in favour of same-sex marriage that they often face when they make their case. And I'm going to do that in 1 minute. The third one is I'll be, in about 5 minutes, sharing some of the very basic facts about the human experience that have made sense to most people to believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. Okay, so that's my three things. Now, a bit of a caveat before I go on any further. Some of you may be thinking, you know, this talk taking place inside the Australian Catholic Youth Festival, nuns and priests and bishops running around everywhere, this is going to be a religious talk. Well, it's not. I have no background in theology or sort of academic qualifications in theology, to be more specific. I'm not a priest. I'm not a seminarian. I think I even got an F in religion in high school, probably. I am, like most of you, a relatively young-ish person just trying to think my way through this issue and grapple with it myself. All right, so number one, how to make you all smarter than 99%. I'm going to say that majority of people think that when it comes to this particular issue, they think like this. Marriage is a great thing. We all agree with that. The only difference is who we should let get married. Okay? So another way of sort of saying that is everyone sort of thinks, yeah, well, marriage is great. We're all on the same page about that. You know, it's just some people have got issues with gay people and therefore they have issues with gay marriage, or some people don't have issues with gay people and therefore they're okay with gay marriage. So that's the main sort of divide, how people think or feel towards gay people. But I think there's one really obvious fact why that's the wrong way of understanding this issue. And that's because there actually are quite a few gay people and also kids of gay parents who love their parents dearly who don't think gay marriage is a good thing, right? So that wouldn't fit that narrative before. That would seem just very confusing. Gay people against gay marriage? How does that sort of work? So what's the alternative way of understanding this issue? Well, I think that it's actually the other way around. It's not what you think or feel about gay people that reflects what you stand on this issue. It's what you think marriage is that reflects where you stand on the issue of gay marriage. And contrary to popular presentation, I think there are actually two very different views, conceptions, pictures, or understandings of what marriage is, and that when you understand those issues, you become much clearer about the particular debate. Now, I think when it comes to it, broadly, there are two sorts of issues. And if you understand these views, sorry, the two views of marriage, if you just understand them, you don't have to accept either of them. You don't have to say, yep, I accept that one or I accept that one. If you just understand them, you're already smarter than a fifth grader and smarter than 99% of the world. Okay, so let's go through a couple of them. The first view has been around for a very long time, pretty much since the start of recorded history. It basically thinks that there's something pretty special about men and women. Their bodies don't really make sense just on their own, and that when men and women come together and fall in love and fall into bed together and make babies and make a family, that it's generally a good thing trying to keep this bundle of things together, right? So under this view, the quote-unquote traditional view of marriage, things like husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, its connection to family life, the importance of it being a permanent relationship, you know, till death to us part type thing, as well as faithful, you know, to you and to you alone, are sort of what makes sense of the whole point of why marriage is around. Okay. Now, as you'll know, there's nothing particularly religious, not even uniquely Catholic, about that particular view. But that's existed alongside a much more recent view of marriage. It's gained a lot of traction in the last 30 or 40 years or so. And this particular understanding of marriage places much more emphasis on the intimacy of the couple, their emotional fulfillment, their happiness as a couple. It's popularly represented in popular culture, TV, radio, film, all that sort of thing. Under this view, family life or having kids is completely optional. It's just up to each couple if they want. There's no sort of inherent connection to it. It's just an option. If they want it, that's great. If they don't, not a problem. Now, I think what is clear from understanding those two particular views is there's nothing particularly very homosexual about either of them. There's nothing particularly gay about either of them. There's also nothing particularly or uniquely religious or Catholic about them as well. So I think if you just understand that, why is it the case then that some people think that there are these strange people who would be against same-sex marriage? Well, I think that's the case if, like most of the 99% people believe, that there's only one view of marriage. It's that newer, sort of sexier soulmate version of marriage, the idea of marrying your BFF, your best friend forever. You know, this is your number one relationship. And if you think that everyone believes that view of marriage, then you're going to be baffled why some people would be against gay people being married, right? Because if gay people and lesbians can form those sorts of deep, committed relationships just like heterosexuals can, then why would some people be against that? Okay? So now you guys are smarter. You know that it's not because someone's homophobic or bigoted that they don't think that's the right way to go. It's because they have an alternate, a different conception of marriage. Well, I should disclose, you could still be homophobic, right, and hold that particular view. But if someone was like that and making arguments, you would find me walking hand in hand with others, critiquing anyone who held such views. But it's not the case that it has to be motivated out of fear or hatred or animus in any sense to gay people. So now what I've said so far, nothing of what I've said about either of those two views proves that either one is right. Okay? I've just sort of laid them out there in front so you can see. So that's even before you get to the same-sex bit. You can just sort of realize that there's two different views about marriage. What it shows in this current debate is it's not about how we think or feel towards gay people that's the real issue. It's much more about what particular idea of marriage we have. All right. Boom. Your IQ is already through the roof, number one. Number two. Now, some people might say, okay, well, that second view of marriage, the sort of romantic soulmate one, that's the view of marriage that I think is right. It sounds really good. And let's be honest, there's many parts about it that are obviously true and are obviously very important, things like intimacy and love and the importance of commitment. So many people sort of think, okay, well, if that's the case and that's what marriage is, then why don't we allow gay people to get married? Well, here are a few concerns I've always had with that just particular idea of what marriage is, the idea of it sort of emotional, deep emotional fulfillment. Here are some obstacles, I think. The first one is it becomes really unclear why it should be just between two people. And when you think about it, many of us could be in loving and committed relationships with more than one person. In fact, in the US and many parts of the world, many different polyamorous or polygamous groupings of people of multiple number who say they're all in loving, committed relationships with people. So why, under this particular view of marriage, is marriage being just about love and commitment, is it limited just to two people? I'm not sure. The other thing is also why vows or that sort of understanding of marriage should see it as something for life, you know, something till death do us part, permanent. Because, you know, if under that idea of marriage is all about the emotional fulfillment and the happiness of the couple, well, then why shouldn't the couple just be free to break it off when the love doesn't last? You know, what's the point of committing to, you know, having permanently good feelings about the other person when we always know that they go up and down? So in that vision of marriage, it makes it really unclear why it should be something for life. And then the other concern I've had with it is, under that particular one, I really don't know what role the government, law, public policy have to do with regulating or being involved in marriage, and essentially sort of putting state approval on, you know, friendships, essentially, just sort of deeply committed friendships. So it's unclear to me that vision of marriage is able to provide a strong framework for some of the things that I think people on both sides of the marriage debate think are important. Things like, you know, that it's for life and that it's between two and that there's a reason why the government's sometimes always been involved in it in some way. Three was some super basic, captain obvious, too dumb not to know facts about the human condition that have generally made it the case that lend good support for it to believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. Now, the first of these, most of you will know, it's the fact that most of us are pretty powerfully attracted and tempted to engaging in acts of love that often bring about new life. So newsflash, sex between men and women can make babies. I know if you didn't know that, it's a little bit awkward in case you have another bird and the bees talk, but you didn't arrive here by stalk. So that's number one, sex makes babies. The second truth is that While you and I can individually and are about whether one day we want to settle down, have a family and bring kids into the world, if a society collectively ums and ahs too long, basically they don't exist. They cease to exist. So the second truth is that society needs babies. And then the third truth that marriage rests is the idea that kids ideally ought to be growing up with their own mother and father. That mothering and fathering, being a mum, being a dad, are just, as one day many of you will know, are just very different experiences and different ways of loving a child into the world and them growing up. So sex makes babies, society needs babies, and babies need a mum and a dad. So what should be clear from just that particular vision of marriage is that there's nothing homophobic about it or anti-gay. There's nothing even inherently religious or Catholic about the particular view. So what's become known throughout many parts of the world as the debate about same-sex marriage, the debate about gay marriage, is less about whom should we let marry and what we think or feel about gay people, and much more about what we understand marriage to be and the importance it has. That's all I wanted to say. I've left the rest of the time to have all of your questions, comments, thoughts. We've got a couple of roving mics that'll make their way around the room, and I'm keen to hear what you think. Thanks, everyone. We have a question just here in the middle. Just over to the side. Do we have two mics by any chance? Maybe we might. Oh, okay.
Thank you, first of all, for giving us this talk. For me, I just wanted to comment on and say that I agree with it and disagree with the way our society is heading, in that our government is going to eventually let this happen, because it's going to happen eventually with same-sex marriage. And the way that I view it is that it's marriage is something that originated in religion. It originated with Judaism, and it's something we should keep between a man and a woman, first of all. And the second thing is that when you're talking about biologically, I subscribe to that thought, to that notion as well, because I see the male and female body, they're made for each other. So yeah, I disagree with the way our society is heading, in that it's going to eventually allow this to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I think the only sort of thought I'd say would be is that I don't think it's the right way to characterize it to say that marriage originated in Judaism. I think if you looked back across any textbook, anthropological textbook, historical textbook that tries to look at different cultures, and as we all know, there are a huge variety of cultures that have existed. Even today, huge variety in cultures, but even more so previously. That you still have in every culture this ritual, this sort of cultural, social fabric that sees men and women coming together. In some cultures, multiple women and one man, but the vast majority, one man, one woman, where they found a way of bridging the sexual divide. It's sort of like a core human experience, and there's lots of rituals and different ceremonies around that, and how it's done here in Australia is quite different from how it's done in other countries. But basically you find this again and again in a variety of places, a way of life that bridges the sexual divide between man and woman. And it's obvious knowledge that that often brings about new life, and that people have generally thought, you know what, we've got to try to do everything we can to get men and women to commit as husbands and wives so that they can become fathers and mothers to any kids that their love brings into the world. So I think it's not just a Judaic or Judeo-Christian understanding, it's a human good, a human way of life. And many religious traditions have sort of, you know, then brought in their own revelation and theology to sort of amplify and extend and enlarge in the scope of that particular thing. But it's really a very basic human phenomenon. Any other questions, thoughts? Yeah, we have another one in the middle here.
So we live in a very progressive society today. And in that society, we've taken a lot of the laws out of the Bible and we've made them apply to today's society, such as like wearing garbs and mixed colouring, etc. So why do the laws of marriage... Why have they been slightly less flexible with those?
So could you phrase it again a little bit? Why have the laws been less flexible with regards to what?
So in regards to marriage, because we live in a very progressive society today. And
you say very oppressive or?
Progressive.
Progressive, sorry, yeah.
And in today's society, it's not uncommon to see gay couples. So in which case, why is society a little more apprehensive in terms of getting the laws of the Bible and then making them applicable to today's society?
Sure. I'm not quite sure how that plays into what I've been saying so much here, because I don't think, I mean, these particular understanding of marriage was shared in societies that didn't have any contact with the Old Testament or the New Testament. I mean, you can just look back at ancient Greece, where this particular vision of marriage, the idea of man and woman coming together and forming, as Plutarch, a Greek philosopher, said, one flesh, right? Now, he used that phrase, and then we've also got that phrase in the Old Testament scripture and also in the New Testament as well. But basically, you've got societies untouched by Hebrew scripture who also had this idea of marriage, and who also, even in particular in ancient Greece, as many of you will know, a highly homoerotic culture, right? They quite celebrated gay love, no problem with that. But in that culture, they even held that there were some relationships that were special because of the significance and the potential that those relationships would bring new life into the world. And so there you have a culture which had no problem with the gay lifestyle. They obviously wouldn't call it gay lifestyle. That word is a relatively new phrase. But they still had those sorts of relationships going on. But then they still understand the good of marriage. So I don't necessarily see some sort of tension with, you know, how is our society progressing and not getting rid of, you know, biblical codes and things like that. I think when it comes to law and public policy, it should be based on public reasons. You know, I don't think particular countries' laws should be, you know, determined like a theocracy or something like that. But that's the beautiful thing about the Catholic faith, is that none of the things that we believe when it comes to the moral life are just only things that we can believe if we're Catholic. I mean, we just don't think that murder is wrong because it's outlawed by the Ten Commandments. I mean, if we didn't even have the Ten Commandments, we would still know that murder is wrong, and we would try to enshrine in our laws a good, healthy understanding of what, you know, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate when it comes to murder and violence. So I think, you know, on lots of public issues, we've got to think the issues through with our minds, whether we're Catholic or not, and the law should be based on those sorts of things. Now, that doesn't mean people of religious faith can't contribute in public discourse. In fact, people of religious faith often have great reasons and additional reasons to contribute to what they think is a good and just order. But they should be willing to articulate those views with people who aren't Catholic in a language and a form that they would find acceptable. That doesn't mean they're going to agree with them. I'm not saying what I'm saying here today, because it's not expressed in theological religious views, means that no one's got an argument against me. I think there are very, very good arguments against my view. I think mine are better. But I think you've got to be able to understand the reasons from both sides on any particular issue, and that'll help you have better conversations with people. Yeah, we've got a flurry of hands on this side, so if we can get a few mics to some of the folk here, I'll let the mic holders decide.
Cheers. Thanks, Pat. I suppose the question I've got is relating to that, more romanticised first version of what people find as marriage, and I suppose the people out there that find themselves attracted to the same sex that want that, and they want that recognised. I suppose what's a charitable response to that? Instead, you know, I know it was in jest, but our argument's better than yours. Yeah, what would be the charitable response to people that only, I suppose, hold that particular view of marriage?
Yeah, well, as I said, there's nothing particularly gay about the view, right? I mean, we would know many people, including many of ourselves, who might think, well, that's what marriage is, right? Marriage just is a deep emotional commitment with a person whom you love. But as I sort of outlined in my talk, I think just irrespective of what we think about same-sex marriage, and I know that view supports gay people being married, but as a view itself, it just is very vulnerable. It's vulnerable because it doesn't seem to me that will help people stick through marriage and stick to it when times get tough, right? Because if marriage is all just about our feelings and how we feel and the couple feels, then when times get tough and the exit option of feeling like, well, you know what, if it really gets tough, then it's just not delivering it to me anymore, I'm not going to stick through it, right? And now you can see the ramifications of that would be not just for the couple, but for the kids of that family. You know, whether they're same sex or not, that particular vision of marriage just sets up a real instability in it. So that would be one thing. And then obviously the it being between two, it means that, you know, anyone who argues that view of marriage really doesn't have much of a leg to stand on to deny polyamorous couples or polygamous couples, you know, multiple arrangements of four or five men or three women, two men, all this sort of thing. You've got really, I mean, I find it really hard to think why you wouldn't extend marriage equality to those loving, committed relationships, especially when they say something like, you know, we've got kids in our household who feel stigmatized because our parents' relationships aren't being recognized, and they would receive the security and benefit if our relationship were recognized to be, you know, socially approved and that sort of thing. So I think under that view, it seems really hard to justify not extending, you know, marriage equality to those groups as well. I think many people who argue that particular sort of view are sort of, they dismiss that as, oh, that's just, you know, scaremongering and scare tactics. But, you know, there's Polyamory Australia and Polyamory in the US of over 500,000 households who are arguing for, you know, marriage equality right now. And I think if I was arguing for that particular view of marriage, I would find it really tough not to say, well, yeah, of course they're allowed to be married. Now, some people may say, well, that's the way it's going. We should just legally recognise all loving, committed relationships. But then you sort of just got to ask yourself at that point, you know, what is the purpose of this whole thing called marriage? Like, are we just offering legal approval on people's adult romantic relationships? Like, what justifies all of this debate and all of these laws and, you know, acts being repealed and referendum if we're just basically putting stamps of approvals on people's adult relationships? It doesn't, all of a sudden, the whole idea becomes a little bit silly. And I think that's because you've gotten further and further away from the public reasons why states and cultures have always been interested in marriage, as opposed to just normal adult friendships or relationships. And that's because the significance of male-female sexual relationships, that they have consequences, public consequences, good public consequences, but consequences that have got to be considered and think, how do we create a culture and a situation where men and women can stay together and raise the child? You know, that often doesn't mean that's exactly why we go into marriage. We're not thinking far in advance, thinking, oh, yes, I'm going into this because I want the government to support my ability to raise children, right? Yeah, you go into that because you love someone, right? But if we grow up in a culture that conceives love as just all about, and marriage all just about love in that sort of intimate sense, then you've really robbed a culture of the idea of friendship, right? Friendship in its own right, the idea of deep commitment with someone of the same sex or the opposite sex, where you will that person's good and that person wills your good just for your own sake. You know? So that's why, unfortunately, we live in a culture where marriage is seen as basically your number one friendship, your maximal friendship. There's nothing different from marriage from other friendships other than it's just more of what you get in friendships. So I think we live in a really highly sort of eroticized culture. That means, you know, if two guys are best friends and they're really good each other, they're really good friends with each other, or even living in the same house, this sort of thing, people might assume, oh, are they gay? What's going on there? You know, we had a question in the last forum where one lady asked a question and said, you know, me and my best friend here, we're not lesbians, but we're very good friends, and we often go out in public to events together, and people have thought that we're in a lesbian relationship. And I was really baffled by that. Like, I could see how that's more the case these days with men, because men are sort of like, you know, we're manly, we don't, you know, we're sort of like, you know, punch guys and chest bump, but apart from that, we don't have, you know, deep emotional connection with guys. But I think that's one of the victims of this particular highly eroticized culture that views marriage as sort of maximal friendship. It means other sorts of valuable forms of friendships go out of way. Question here in the middle, yeah.
Patrick, thanks for the talk. Question just is, I know there's a lot of high school kids and university students in the audience here.
Yes, sorry.
And I think they're probably often surrounded by, a bit of an environment that suggests to them that the debate is they should just concede and that it's over. I personally think it's far from that. But in your experiences, you know, what have you found out in the public sphere in relation to that? And, you know, what advice would you give to especially the younger kids who maybe have that idea in their head that the people around them are saying, look, you're just behind with the times, you just got to concede and move on. It's something that wider society is just, you know, getting on with, especially when we look at the global context. So,
yeah, that's a very good question. In my experience, well, I've given talks similar to this, not this exact one, but similar talks on same-sex marriage at universities across Australia and across the US. And the most common experience I've had at the end of it, and usually in those audiences, it'll be 99.9% of people will be against my view, right? So this is a very friendly crowd compared to what I'm usually used to. And what I've found is that a lot of people who've come to my talk have said to me after, Look, I don't agree with you, and I don't accept your view, but I've got to say I've never heard it expressed like that, or I've never actually heard that view said like that before. That's the most common experience I have. So what I've learned from that, and I've spoken with other people who've spoken this issue, and they say it is too, what that makes me think is this view hasn't been heard and then rejected because it's, you know, it doesn't make sense or it's bigoted or it's homophobic. It simply hasn't been heard. And one of the reasons why it hasn't been heard is because the other side have done so well to convince so many people, including many of us, I think, that to hold this view, you've got to be a bigot. You've got to be a homophobe. You can't have gay friends and hold this view. You must be hateful and oppressive of gay people. You must not want them to be happy, right? Now, in any other debate or in any other sort of social setting on any other matter, if anyone acted like that, you would know exactly what that is. It's called bullying. It's called intimidation tactics, right? Name-calling, charging someone down as being a bigot or a homophobe, all it does is to try and instill in us a desire not to speak out for what we believe in. Right? That's all it's done. And I think with most people, they've been hit by the bigot, you know, punch. And then the next one is the inevitable one, which you pointed out as well. The idea, look, it's just coming, get on the right side of history, move out of the way, it's going to happen no matter whatever you do. And I think to most of us, that sort of just saps our energy. It just sort of makes us feel like, oh, gosh. And then maybe to some extent, we start to internalize those criticisms and start to think, you know what? Maybe there is something right. Maybe this view is a little bit bigoted. Maybe I've got to be more progressive. Maybe I've got to get sort of up to speed with how things are going. And I just think that's basically people who've been bullied into silence. So the first thing is I think, don't be intimidated. And the first thing you do with a schoolyard bully is you stand up to bullies. You call them out on that. That doesn't mean you be a bully back, right? So when we're arguing for our view, nothing discriminatory, hateful, oppressive should be said, because I don't think we should believe that. But that's why I don't think this particular vision of marriage is oppressive or hateful. As an institution, what it arose to solve was not whether people were attracted to the same sex. That's not what the institution of marriage ever got around to doing. It was around to solve the sexual divide between men and women. So it's largely quite a different issue. So those are my main sort of thoughts on the sort of inevitability and charges of name-calling and things. Yes, we have a question here in the middle. Yeah, go.
In various debates that I've entered into, an argument that I've come up against regularly is that for society as a whole, marriage is in fact a redundant institution. And legally speaking, in Australia, same-sex union is not required, because if an same-sex attracted couple elopes and marries overseas, that certificate registering the marriage there is enough for them to obtain a de facto status here in Australia. Or on the other hand, a de facto partnership can in fact have the same legal standing as a marriage if a same-sex couple lives together for a period of 6 months. So on that basis, I'm not asking if you believe it is spiritually redundant, because as we know, it is an essential part of our faith. But could it be fair to say that in today's society, marriage is a legally redundant institution?
Look, you could argue that, and you could put arguments for inside. I don't think it would be good to go that way, to conceive of marriage as a sort of redundant institution. Marriage as a, when we say as an institution, first of all, whenever I say the word institution, I've got to be careful, because you sort of think, that just sounds so archaic, and, you know, institution, is that like some building somewhere? Like, what's this marriage institution? The word institution just means a pattern of values and norms, cultural sort of collections of the way things are done, what's right in this sort of thing. I mean, think of it as an educational institution. Educational institutions have certain norms and values, the idea that truth and honesty and research is important, you don't lie and all that sort of thing, you don't corrupt your work by cheating. So that's how an educational institutional mindset works, but the good of truth, and that gives you certain norms and values. Now, I think when it comes to marriage and marrying, it shouldn't be redundant, because all of us, when we're young and growing up, let's be honest, a lot of us don't really know too much about how relationships go really well. We spend most of our 20s and 30s, messing up and trying to figure out how to do it better, and we grow up and we mature. And marriage as an institution, as a sort of value-based thing that says, no, this is something for life, something where you commit to someone. It's about bringing your family to the world, raising them up. All these sorts of things help us when it comes to making decisions about both preparing for marriage and then when we're in marriage, how to live that out well. I think if you say, let's get out of the marriage business, everyone can marry whatever they want and the law should have nothing in it, it's completely redundant. What that sends a message to most young people, us, would be that, okay, you've got to figure it out on your own. Go your own way, make these things up as they go, and whatever sort of feels good fits. I think that way of growing up in a marriage culture is probably not going to keep families together very long, because I think we all sorts of need those sorts of cultural supports that tell us how we go about building those sorts of relationships. So I would argue against it being redundant and hopefully find ways that we can build it up to be better. We've got a bunch of questions from the Sydney crowd over here. Maybe we can get a mic to a few of them. Oh, yeah, and one up the front while the mic's getting over there. Yeah.
Hey. So the thing is, so what's the alternative? So you're saying that marriage equality is something that we should deny and leave. But there's definitely, what I can see, definitely a move, like you said, in the past 30, 40 years of this being something like an expanded human consciousness sort of thing, and maybe marriage equality isn't the right way to go. But is there any alternative that you see as morally fit? I mean, you can answer it on a purely secular level or religious or whatever you feel fit.
Sure. Well, the first thing I'd probably say is that I'm actually in favour of marriage equality. And I would hope everyone here is in favour of marriage equality. I mean, don't we all want the law to recognise and treat all genuine marriages equally? Good. Yeah, everyone sort of... raise your hand if you don't think we should recognise marriages equally, right? No one. Exactly. We're all believing in marriage equality. But before we know what the law, whether we're violating equality or not, we've got to have some idea of what marriage is to be able to know how to equally apply it, right? Because then we can figure out whether the law is being discriminatory or not. Okay. So we've got to have some idea of what marriage is before we can say it's being equality in its application is being violated. Okay. So in other words, let me picture another way. If marriage was just recognizing adult committed relationships, okay? Would adult committed relationships of three people be denied marriage equality? They would, wouldn't they? Right? If there's an adult relationship, a committed relationship of three people living together, raising kids, they're in a committed, loving sexual relationship, would marriage equality be denied to them if marriage was relationships that are loving and committed? It would, wouldn't it? So you wouldn't just be able to say, well, you're against marriage equality then for three-person relationships. You'd say, well, no, wait a second. A marriage just is between two people. It's not a matter of equality. It's a matter of getting a picture of understanding of what marriage is before you can then know what relationships it should be applied to. So that's what I'm saying on this issue here. You've got to have a particular vision of marriage before you can say it's violating equality. So I do believe in marriage equality, marriage understood as the sort of relationship that bridges the sexual divide between men and women. Then it's not being denied between two same-sex couples because two men of the same sex do not want to do that sort of thing, which is marriage, which is bridging the sexual divide and unfolding into family and domestic life, right? They want to do something sort of similar. Many of it looks the same. The many common features like commitment and love and the possibility of maybe bringing kids in. But those things aren't all the things that make sense of marriage fully. So what's the alternative to it? The alternative to it is... Okay, so what's the alternative for gay people if gay marriage is impossible? Well, for starters, I'd think an alternative would be not conceiving and thinking that the only fulfilling relationship can be found in a married relationship. I think we've come to a point where we start to see marriage as basically the number one sort of relationship, okay? And I think what happens in a culture that conceives marriage as the highest thing, the thing that provides us deep fulfillment, it means we tend to neglect and substitute the possibility of genuinely deep and rich and profound friendships. And I think one of the side effects of this debate around same-sex marriage is that it's made it really unclear where friendships are and marriage, because marriage just seems like your number one friendship. So all the other friendships just seem like less than, not as important, because it's not a marital friendship. And so I think profoundly deep. And this is one of the things, in the Catholic tradition, St. Aelred wrote a book on spiritual friendship. It's one of the most moving testimonies on friendship. And I think that sort of thing is a possibility, not just for same-sex people, but for people of any attraction, whatever, is of having a rich and diverse and really profound life of friendship and friends and lots of friends in a community. I think all of those things are very important, whether you end up getting married or not. Yes, we have a couple of questions. Oh, sorry, the Sydney crowd up here, a few questions. Yeah.
I'm just going to take it back to a idea that you suggested before. I think there was a bit of a generalization when you said that people who are against homosexuality are being called bigots and homophobes, because I am with same-sex marriage and I respect everyone's ideas. Like, I don't put them down. I don't categorize them as homophobic. I just believe that we have opposing views. I sort of think it's the other way around. Like, when you segregate the homosexual relationships, you sort of, I think that's what's building the homophobia. Like you said, with the two women who were out public and they were being asked if they were a lesbian couple, I don't think that it should be an offensive comment if you're asking if you're a lesbian couple. There's nothing wrong with being a lesbian couple. I think that, like, it's just like any other relationship. It's more than a friendship, and that's why I think people want to celebrate it in a marital commitment, like, so they can share it with their friends and their family, just like man and woman. Like, I don't think that there should be a segregation. Like, I don't think that homosexuality should be different from a man and woman relationship.
Thank you for your question or comment. Thank you. I fully understand that. I think there are just, I'm not quite sure that under that idea of marriage, why any of the things that we talked about before, why they would still be held as very important under that view. So I'm not questioning the sort of the same sex bit of it. I just think there's been a lot of things that have happened over the last 30 or 40 years that have probably chipped away at our cultural understanding of what marriage is all about, such that it's got to the point now where it's, I mean, interesting thing about, you know, what I call the soulmate model and as opposed to the sort of more traditional model is that the traditional man-woman model often viewed marriage as a gateway to responsibility. The idea that marriage is the point where you really settle down, commit, and you take upon yourself a great responsibility and you bring with you to celebrate that and to also help you get through that, a lot of people who are going to say, we're going to be with you now and into the future and into your family's future and their future and their family's future. And that's the sort of the older, more traditional model of marriage, whereas the newer one sees marriage not so much as a gateway to responsibility but as a sort of capstone. By capstone, I mean sort of like we've made it. Like our relationship is here. We want to let everyone know that we're married. We want to sort of receive social approval on our committed, loving relationship. And I understand that desire today, but it's a different sort of thing from the other one, and I'm just not sure that that gets what marriage right. So those are some of my sort of concerns about that particular idea of marriage. Yeah, in the middle, I think, or unless there were more questions in that area. So we've got two questions over here, one in the middle and then one on the edge.
It's not actually a question, it's more of a comment, sure, sort of thing of what you were saying before.
Yeah.
It's hard to say that you can stand up to a bully when you're in that sort of situation. But what about when it's outside of school and your family turns against you, your church turns against you, and that's what really puts all of these gay people in the closet, because of the fact that they're too terrified to say anything because their families are embarrassed about them, their friends are embarrassed to be around them, and the church don't want them near them.
Well, I think all of us should be doing everything we can to rid any community of any bullying, intimidation that happens. And no one should be ostracized. No one should be isolated. Everyone should have good friendships. Everyone should be grafted onto communities, whether they be church communities or social groups. And I think that's got to be part and parcel of the way we live. I mean, if we're serious about being Christians, we've got to be serious about that. I don't think there's any particular link between the vision of marriage that I've shared and a sort of a harm, an intrinsic harm to young LGBTI people. I think it's largely a culture that has sort of said, that view is so bigoted, it's so homophobic, it is really aimed at and oppressing gay people. And I just think that's a lie. But I think it's been said so often that many young LGBTI people have seen that as true. I guess that's the way it is. Yeah, it is really oppressive. That they're just not allowing me to be married. It must be motivated by animus. And I think that's where the bullying comes in. So I think wherever bullying exists, it's got to be rid of. And in which case, you'll find me doing everything I can to help you and anyone else make sure that that's the case. I think we had a question to the right of the previous question. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
So I've heard people say that if gay marriage doesn't make sense because marriage is supposed to be so much about children and family life, what does that mean for infertile couples? You know, why would an infertile couple be allowed to get married if they're not able to naturally have children? And I've never actually heard a convincing answer on that, so I was just hoping you could expand on that a little bit.
Sure, no worries. A very good question. Did everyone hear that? It's just about, you know, if infertile couples are able to get married and they can't conceive having kids, well, then what's the difference then with same-sex couples? Because if they're, you know, infertile in the same way, or obviously in a different way, then why can't they be allowed to be married? I think it's important to disassociate myself from a sort of extreme view of marriage that thinks marriage is all about making babies. It's just instrumental as a means to making babies, right? I don't hold that view, nor is this particular view associated with that. I'd call that view like the King Henry VIII view, right, who kept marrying multiple people and then, I don't know, divorcing them until he got one that brought about a baby, right? So that's a view I don't think is right. Well, what do I do think is right? First thing to note is when it comes to infertility, it's very rare that both people in the relationship are infertile. It's usually often one or the other. And in many cases, it's the case that infertility can be treated, okay, can be helped, and the couple can actually achieve pregnancy. In many cases where one of the persons in a couple is infertile, they often look to adoption and to try and see if they can raise a child and give them the blessing of having a mum and a dad. So most couples who face infertility still end up having kids, whether through being helped through dealing with issues of infertility or through adopting. But the important thing I think to think here is for the couples that do experience that great difficulty, it's experienced as a real cross, right? As a sort of lack, as an acknowledgement on their part that there's something that should be there that isn't. There's an impediment to them conceiving, right? So something that they know is where that should be there isn't there. And I think that reinforces only more the strong link that everyone knows exists between men and women and a committed married couple and to family life, right? And they're realizing it's a frustration because something that should be there and is an obvious link isn't being achieved. Now, that same sort of difficulty and anxiety isn't present between same-sex couples. No two men or no two women are going to sort of go, why isn't it possible that we're not conceiving? Why isn't our relationship bearing fruit, new life, right? Because everyone knows that that's not the sort of relationship that brings new kids into the world. It's just not aimed in that direction. So if anything, the strongest, you know, sort of usual, the silver bullet argument, the infertility argument, I think often reinforces even stronger the idea that we intuitively know that relationships between men and women are sort of inherently oriented towards family life, even when through some impediment, through no fault of their own, they're unable to conceive. And the other thing to note about that is just, I mean, everyone have always known that not every marriage ends up bringing kids into the world, but we do know that every kid brought into the world in that marriage has a mother and a father, and that's why marriage has been understood between a man and a woman. So hopefully that sort of gets somewhat close to it, but I know it's a difficult thing to sort of, you know, to understand sometimes. I'll just say wherever the mic is.
Yeah. Question here.
I can't see either. Sorry. Go for it. Yeah.
Do you think society has made a big issue out of something that at the end of the day boils down to the point that we're forcing people to decide who they should and shouldn't love when in reality we can't tell people who they can and can't love. It's a thing destined from birth. So when compared to issues such as poverty, famine, war, do you think society has made a big issue out of something so small?
It's a good question. I don't think the government has any right or interest, nor should we really have any right or interest in telling people whom they can and cannot love. I've got no business people telling people who they can and can't love, right? The issue is not about whether we can or can't love someone. The issue is whether we should understand marriage to be about bringing men and women together and keeping them together with their sons and daughters, or whether we should change completely that vision of marriage and say it's about the emotional intimacy of consenting adults. And that's the issue. And the reason why we have an interest in that is because if that becomes the law, then the law is for everyone teaches a particular new vision of marriage. It says marriage is not about bringing men and women together as husbands and wives to become fathers and mothers to any kids that their love brings into the world. It says marriage is about your loving, committed relationships. And I think then you've got the same issues that we talked about before, why it should be permanent, why it should be just between two, why the government's really caring, like you rightfully said, about telling us whom we should and shouldn't love. So yeah, I would much prefer us not to be having this particular debate. I'd prefer people to be in loving, committed, deep friendships, you know, whether they were same sex or not, publicly recognized or not, whatever that sort of way, people to have genuinely fulfilling relationships, and for also a sound and healthy, robust marriage culture to be happening so that kids grew up and were loved by the two people, the mother and the father, who brought them into the world. I think that would be a great thing. And then we can solve all sorts of the other issues. But I think when it comes to poverty, one of the biggest indicators and sort of factors of poverty in the States, particularly over there because they've got a lot of the research, is because of family breakdown. When you have massive family breakdown in some of the poorer black Hispanic communities, and they are the communities that are experiencing the greatest poverty rates. So if we're really interested in poverty, we should be really interested in a healthy marriage culture. So I don't think we can just sort of separate and cordon off these issues and just sort of think, well, we'll just let marriage go and just each to their own, and then think that somehow we can look after poverty in the abstract without thinking about how to keep families and households and communities together. I think that's a sort of both end type situation. Yeah, we have very, very good persistent person in the middle who's been waiting for the mic. No, just a little bit further. That's it, yeah.
Now, this is a bit of a different question, but yeah, with regards to your sort of views on how the views of marriage and that your how you define marriage is more relevant to marriage equality than how you think of gay people. It's a very interesting view, and I've never heard it before, and I was wondering where you were exposed to this idea, whether this was a personal revelation or you heard it somewhere else.
Sure. Well, I think largely I got involved in the marriage issue because I just became really frustrated with the way it was being discussed in, you know, on TV, amongst my friends. And I just found there was lots of name calling and on both sides and sort of stonewalling and just sort of, you know, like this really a real polarized sort of culture. And you see that now all on TV and the way the issue is discussed, it's just so hard to talk about it, right, without feeling like, you know, you're getting angry with someone. So the first thing is I was unhappy with how it had been discussed and sort of thought, okay, there's got to be a way of talking about issues that people disagree on without, you know, getting up in your fisticuffs. So that was a sort of more sort of personal type thing. And then being Catholic, I also realized, yeah, okay, my church teaches this, but my church also says that I've got a brain and that I've got a mind and I can think. And one of the beautiful things about the Catholic tradition, as opposed to some other religious traditions, is that it has a very, very big emphasis on the importance of our brains and our thinking through of certain issues. And the more I looked into it, the more I looked into what I think were the best arguments in favour of same-sex marriage, I just found that the other arguments against it and the other arguments for a sounder view of marriage just seemed so much more stronger. And so I was led to thinkers, sort of public intellectuals, writers, academics in the States, the UK and Australia, many of them Catholic, many of them not, who'd thought this issue through, particularly people actually who've been working on building up a strong marriage culture before the whole same-sex marriage debate, people who saw, you know, widespread fatherlessness and breakdowns of family homes as real issues to be worked on. I really thought they were doing a real good job trying to build up a healthy marriage culture. And then the same-sex marriage debate sort of came out of nowhere about 10 years ago and then made all of that, all of those research and work on what really built, what family structure really helps and the importance of mums and dads and just made that sort of untouchable, You know, you could no longer say that stuff because to say that means you're hateful of gay people. I mean, it was just like it sort of switched very quickly in the space of about 5 years. And so, reading the research of social scientists, philosophers, thinkers, non-Catholics, Catholics, just sort of led me to think, yeah, there's actually a really good vision of marriage here. It makes sense. It's what the faith teaches, but it's also what, you know, my mind sort of seems to go, yeah, that makes a bit of sense. Question up the back.
Hi.
Hi.
At the end of the day, do you think that your ideas or your religion's ideas or anyone else's beliefs about what marriage should be defined as and what part it should play in our culture have any right impeding on what other people who don't prescribe to those beliefs can and cannot do?
I think all of us have got to think through this issue for ourselves. We've also got to really look at the best arguments on our side, the best arguments on another side. And when it comes to setting up laws, that's a communal exercise. I mean, politics is the great art of thinking how we are to live our lives together, right? So lawmaking is for the sake of the common good for everyone. And when we do that, we've got to think, okay, whatever situation of society or culture or law that's got to be there, I can't just think for myself or my group or my religion, what's just good for me. I've got to think about the common good, right? So whatever vision of marriage you pitch forward, it's got to be one that you think will genuinely help all people. And that's what I think is what I'm trying to say here. And I think people on the other side who disagree with me, many of you here, will be thinking, well, this vision of marriage, I think, is a better vision of marriage that also satisfies all and is the right thing for all people too. So I don't think I'm being hypocritical myself. I think people who argue in favour of same-sex marriage think that it's good also for everyone too, and that it's a better, a more just, more fair society. And I think they could only be thinking that correctly if they thought that was the case for everyone, not just for a segment of the population, but it sort of, you know, denied other people. Does that sort of get at what you were thinking? Feel free to... Yeah. No worries. Yes, we have a question down here at the front and in the middle too.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for your talk today. My question isn't really sort of a question. It's sort of a comment because my class actually discussed about it, and we're a SOR, Studies Religion 2 unit class. And after the Archbishop's message of the book that he has sent out to our schools, we actually had a discussion about it quite a bit.
Mm.
You know, and it's pretty important, you know, growing up for me especially, or if you're a Catholic, it's always been, that's the law. You know, we just previously can't change it for our belief. And it's where we actually discussed it quite a bit. And we discussed it for about more than half an hour.
Mm.
And our teacher said to us, well, it's more because you just, you know, a male and female, you know, they're basically the role models. You just can't replace it, you know, with two males. So the kid, you've got to think about the kid as well. You know, if the kid's adopted and the kid says, well, who's the mother? You know, you just can't say, or if it's even a female relationship, two females, you know, a female can never take over dad's place, a male can never take over a mother's place. And we have to really, I think, understand that a lot, because some people really forget. You know, I'm not trying to say to the people that are against it, I'm not against it, I'm just saying, you know, you just can't change it, you know. And we've got to think about the kid, especially because it's more what the kid believes in. Because let's say if the kid, you know, asks us the question about, oh, who's my dad, for example, you know, or any question, probably a mother couldn't answer, or if they're, you know, lesbian or gay. So I think that's what we came up with, and that's what we said, is that, you know, a mother and two mothers, if a kid asks a question and it's more a question for a male, how are they going to answer it? Because they're not grown up in that role.
Yeah.
And that's what we sort of came up as a class, because we discussed it quite a bit and we're still continuing to discuss it as well.
Good on you.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, I'm not trying to tell anyone that this is what we said, this is how it should be. It's just what we came up with, our perspective on it. Thanks, Pat.
Sorry, can I interrupt? I've got the microphone on me. I'm
back. Sorry. Yes, hello, yeah.
I grew up in a family with just a mother, and it's possible and it's fine, and people can find male role models and different role models out of assigned gender identities.
Yeah. No, it's... I mean, it's... There's there's nothing historically new about many of this. I mean, we've always known that there's been many times throughout history people have been raised by single moms, single dads, you know, convents. There's that the fact that people have grown up in various types of households should not be a surprise to any of us. I think the question we've got to ask ourselves is, what vision of marriage should the law support as the ideal situation, right? You know, many people in this debate, they sort of use the fact that people have grown up in different households as an argument for recognition of all those types of households as married. That they're sort of, you know, they're all each their own, there's no difference, all this sort of thing. I don't see how those two sort of go together quite like that way. I think we've got to have basically a vision of, well, is there a situation that we think is the ideal, acknowledging fully that there's lots of difference and diversity, but is our culture going to send a message that, you know, as opposed to all the variety of ways, we think that there's one way that is ideally the best for most people? And at least when it comes to the social science, that is, you know, social science doesn't sound particularly interesting, and it's lots of data and statistics and methods and investigations. But generally, before the whole same-sex marriage debate came around, the consensus among family law scholarships was that the ideal situation for the best outcomes and a whole variety of measures for kids was being raised with their biological mother and father. But as you rightfully said, that does not prove that everyone who grows up without a mother or father experiences all those outcomes or some of the negative ones. In fact, many of them, yourself probably very included, grew up just fine and wonderful, and there's nothing wrong with that. We've just got to think, as a matter of law, which works with the generality and everyone, not just particular circumstances, what's the ideal situation? And that's particularly what they've thought marriage between a man and a woman would do. Yeah, you're right there in the middle. Go for it.
Yeah, I don't really understand because, like, the argument of because they can be parents, because just because you can conceive a child doesn't make you a parent. And I think that homosexual couples can be great parents as well. It's about how you nurture a child. And there's plenty of kids out there that are in have heterosexual parents, and they've been abused and they have alcoholic parents. And there's, you know, parents out there that, homosexual parents that could bring them up just as well as heterosexual parents can.
Yeah, no, look, I fully agree. I think, you know, there can be gay parents who do a much better job at parenting than some heterosexual parents. You know, and we could probably point out a whole variety of cases that's the case. I fully agree, but I don't ever think a man can be a mum, and I don't ever think, you know, a woman can be a dad. And I think creating a culture where we bring kids into the world from the very beginning without any contact with either their mother or their father is not probably an ideal situation. You know, two mummies can't make a dad. And I think there's something, I don't think parenting is androgynous, you know. I don't think it's just sort of parenting is some general abstract category. I think there's something distinctive and valuable about men and women, about mothers' connections to their daughters, about fathers' connections to their daughters and sons that's important, and that's sort of what marriage has been traditionally around with. But you can say something, you can respond if you have the mic. Yeah.
Just coming back to what you're talking about with civil legislative processes, as a teacher teaching in a high school, we, especially in a lot of the HSIE faculties, we teach a lot about human rights and we sort of teach about things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We talk about the American independence and the Declaration they established, and variety of other declarations that reference equal rights and that talk about marriage equality and marriage rights, the right to marry whom you choose. With a lot of these arguments, how do we rectify this issue and connect it back to the society's agreed human rights and the human rights that a lot of societies say are fundamental to being human?
Yeah, I think there's been a proliferation of rights talk in the last 15, 20 years. You know, we're very comfortable, particularly in the States, but we've got it also here as well, talking in the language of rights. And many of that is good and important, but also rights also send a very sort of, you know, me and my right to this centred type vision. Whatever the issue is, if you just say I have a right to this, right to that, it's very much about me, my rights, what I want, Whereas traditionally, the language of rights was understood in the context of obligations, that we have rights because we have duties and obligations. And I think when it comes to family life, it doesn't really capture the idea of marriage and family to speak of it in the language fully of rights. So I think to the extent that we can sort of avoid using rights language, we avoid most of those problems that come up when that happens. And when we can then start to understand marriage more as about duties and obligations of giving of oneself to the other in the sort of fullness that that requires of marriage and oneself fully to one's children, I think that'll go some way towards rectifying a more, I think, individualistic sort of way of conceiving of marriage as a sort of right. Or sort of, so I think that's sort of one step in the right direction. In the right direction. I think that may be all my time. You've been wonderful, everyone. Thank you very much.
That was Patrick Langrell with Making Sense of Marriage. This talk and Q&A session is from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015 and was recorded as a collaboration between XT3 and Cradio. And for more from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival, and for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.